From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College, this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
Welcome back to Narrow Passages, War News Radio's series on the Syrian refugee crisis and the U.S. resettlement process. My name is George Menz.
And I'm Matthew Chaffinch.
In our last segment, we looked at the broad problems with U.S. and international refugee resettlement institutions as a whole. This week, we will narrow in on more specific challenges refugees face along the way. We will also continue our conversation with folks from the private organizations that actually do the bulk of the social and legal work refugees need. For those of you who did not tune in last week, these hardworking professionals are Judy Bernstein Baker from Hyas, Pennsylvania, and Jonah Eaton from the Nationality Services Center. Both organizations offer many services, including but not limited to financial, legal, and professional support for refugees who are accepted into the U.S. Judy and Jonah helped us to explore some of the concrete problems that impact people once they are displaced from their homes in Syria. We want to ask, what are the different paths that a Syrian might follow between displacement and resettlement? In tracing out these processes, we especially want to examine the many ways that opportunities for resettlement are unequally distributed from start to finish. But to do that, we need to start from the beginning. So how does one become a refugee?
This question is more complex than it might seem. As we discussed last week, the internationally recognized definition of a refugee is actually very specific. First of all, even if their homes have been destroyed, a Syrian resident does not become a refugee until they cross the border out of Syria. People who have fled their homes are not called refugees, but internally displaced persons, up until they choose to or are able to enter a neighboring country.
But the legal complications do not stop at the border. Once expatriated, a displaced person does not automatically achieve official refugee status. Syrian refugees must be able to demonstrate that they face a credible fear of persecution if they are to return to their home country. This credible fear is a specified legal term, and the fear must also be related to one of five criteria: either race, religion, national origin, political opinion, or membership in a social group.
Regardless of which of these criteria is used, every individual refugee must make a case for refugee status and must be certified by a legal body. So there are two relatively separate legal processes for testing and affirming refugee status. The most common type in the U.S. resettlement process is conducted by an international agency and occurs outside of the country that the refugee will be resettled in.
But there is another type that is a little more complicated. The other process happens when a person applies for resettlement in a country that they reside in without first going through the legal process abroad. These people are not called refugees, but asylum seekers, and their cases are adjudicated within the legal system of their country of residence. Last week, we talked with Jonah Eaton, a staff attorney at the Nationality Services Center who assists refugee applicants and immigrants navigating the U.S. legal system, about legal aspects of the refugee process. Let's go back to that conversation.
I mostly do asylum law. That's sort of the other prong that you access international protection. So if you manage to get here on your own steam, you can then apply for asylum in the United States. You're legally kind of doing the same thing. You're asking to be recognized as a refugee. But that happens, you know, that sort of adjudication happens here in the U.S. before an asylum officer or before an immigration judge.
Compared to official refugees, asylum seekers can face even greater complications in the resettlement process. Problems are especially likely if the person in question applies for asylum at the border rather than applying after already residing in the country on a valid visa.
There are the people who are applying for asylum who come here in a different status. For example, the student who came here and then is applying, they go through one pathway to apply for asylum. It's called affirmative asylum. However, if that same person fled Syria and somehow got to the United States, say, through the Mexican border, and presented themselves at the border asking for asylum, that's a very different process. Then that person will be immediately put in detention.
That was Judy Bernstein Baker, who we also talked to last week. Judy is the executive director at Hyas, Pennsylvania, one of the oldest refugee resettlement organizations in the country. So, from the point of being detained, the asylum seeker begins the arduous and complicated background check process within the U.S. legal system, starting with an interview with an asylum officer. For asylum seekers who have a visa and are not stuck in detention, the wait for that initial interview at an asylum office can take years.
And even after that long wait, getting rejected in this initial interview means that the case goes back to immigration courts.
You sort of do the same process over again, only it's more legally formal. You're in front of a judge, and there's a Department of Homeland Security lawyer sort of sitting opposite you, usually effectively arguing for the applicant's removal from the country.
The asylum-seeking process can be long, complex, and harrowing. But the alternative is not necessarily better. The official refugee process, which largely takes place outside of the destination country, can be just as frustrating and dangerous.
You, in most cases, have ended up in a refugee camp somewhere, and then you get recognized as a refugee and sort of nominated by resettlement, usually by the United Nations, sometimes there's other partner agencies that do that. And there's an extensive screening process that can take years through the U.S. State Department, and then people, you know, get permission to come here to the United States. So by the time the refugee gets here into the U.S., sort of the initial kind of legal step, the status determination, figuring out that person meets the definition of refugee, has already happened.
But there are many ways in which this already uncertain path can become more complicated and difficult, and the opportunities for entrance into this resettlement process are not equally distributed among displaced Syrians.
We spoke with both Jonah and Judy about the less visible challenges that face refugees entering into the resettlement process. These challenges are not just legal, but cultural, economic, personal, geographic. For two individuals that both match the definition for a refugee on paper, outcomes and options might be entirely different.
So, I mean, when you have a situation, you know, like the Syrian conflict, you're going to be looking at the people who are probably seeing the most success, is that there are sort of socioeconomic conditions, there are sort of factors, I think. I think people who are more comfortable in English are going to get a leg up. People who can now then also show that they were, you know, involved in sort of the early kind of Arab Spring protests. That's, you know, if they can actually prove that they were there, you know, through photographs or whatever, then that's going to definitely be advantageous for them. Whereas some of the later waves, who it was more just like somebody was dropping bombs on my house and I'm not even sure who the hell it was. I mean, that again can be more difficult just because, you know, that generalized violence is not sufficient. You need to show sort of, you know, the particular connection to one of the grounds.
This last part, about the material ability to demonstrate a connection to one of the five criteria, is very important. Someone who is outspoken in Syrian politics before the crisis, or who has a relationship with international agencies, can have an easier time in the resettlement process, not only because they might have connections with people in the international community, but also because those connections count as material evidence in determining refugee status.
So the strongest cases are ones where you have relatively high-profile people, right, activists or things of that nature. I've had clients before where, you know, the BBC might have done a story about sort of their political activities in their country of origin or something like that. So that is very strong evidence because it's, you know, it was at the time, it's a, you know, third-party sort of impartial source documenting what this person was doing and what happened to them.
In general, the evidence makes the case. Throughout the conversation with Jonah, we learned about the strengths and pitfalls of the evidence-based approach required in resettlement cases.
The normal U.S. standards for legal evidence wouldn't work with refugee procedures.
You know, in the criminal context, it would be like, you know, you have to sort of maintain chain of custody over a piece of evidence to make sure it was never tampered with. If those standards applied to immigration proceedings, no one would ever get asylum just because, you know, if you're fleeing your country in the middle of the night, you're not going to necessarily have time to get a bunch of documents certified before you leave. So, you know, it is possible to get a grant just based on a person's story. And usually, I mean, backed up by sort of country conditions, right? So that there's usually sort of the two parts of any asylum cases, the person's individualized story, and then lots of third-party sources about what is going on in this country, and then fitting their individual story into larger events.
As Jonah explained, the fact that refugee courts accept individual testimony as sufficient evidence is very important. At the same time, even this resource is distributed unevenly among refugees. In the absence of documentation of a job, religious membership, or political affiliation that might imply a threat of violence, all the refugees got, so to speak, is their memory. But memory is imperfect and often falls short of the expectations of a judge.
If it's someone more obscure, you're much more relying on, you know, the person's particular story, and can they credibly sort of tell this and consistently tell the story. And that's just harder. And it's also kind of unfair because some people are going to be better at that than others, just sort of intrinsically. And, you know, memory is kind of a fickle, hazy thing. And, you know, if, you know, adjudicators tend to really fixate on dates and times and things like that, and sort of all these sort of minute details as sort of a way to assess credibility, which I think is, you know, it's probably like some pseudoscience and some bad assumptions in there about how memories actually work. But on the other hand, you know, from an adjudicator standpoint, they're, you know, it is a very difficult kind of thing they have to do, is basically assess, is this person telling the truth based purely on what they're telling me. So that's tough.
These issues with memory are also impacted by the range of traumatic experiences that refugees can face, both in Syria and once they leave.
I mean, one example that sort of springs to mind is I've got one current client now who was originally from Egypt. I mean, and his PTSD is just dramatic. I mean, he sort of starts to tell his story and just will invariably completely fall apart. As a legal question, you know, that story has to be clearly and sort of credibly presented to the officer. And so PTSD can be an enormous sort of challenge to that. One of the other nasty things about this is that there's actually a one-year deadline in, from your entry into the U.S. as to when you can apply for asylum, after which it becomes much harder. You know, we know something very bad happened, and we have the basics of the story. But the worry is, you know, he's got to tell a very sort of consistent and detailed story to that officer in order to get a grant. And he's just having trouble talking about it right now. You know, if we can't get him to a point where he can sort of, you know, talk about this, you know, it might be very difficult to get the grant. And it's awful for the applicant, I mean, because, you know, they're sitting in their attorney's office and, you know, we sort of are sometimes effectively sort of re-traumatizing them every time we make them walk through this story of, you know, what happened to them in the past. You try to minimize that as much as possible, but in many cases it's, you know, it's necessary in order to prepare them to present their case.
The issue of re-traumatization that Jonah pointed out is also part and parcel of the very intensive background check interviews required of refugees resettled in the U.S.
If you're a refugee in a refugee camp trying to enter into the resettlement process, you're going to have to tell this story multiple times, you know, first to a UN officer and then to a State Department official, oftentimes, you know, multiple times to them, because one of the ways they sort of screen or sort of rigorously screen on these applicants is that they re-interview them, you know, many, many times. So they're sort of telling the same story over and over again.
Right, and that can be traumatic in and of itself.
Right, correct.
The strict security requirements of the resettlement process can also pose problems for refugees in other ways, even if they are not suffering from acute traumatic stress. A relatively recent addition to the refugee law in the U.S. is the so-called Material Support Clause. This rule was introduced as part of the Patriot Act in 2001, in the direct aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. The law defines what counts as illegal activity in support of terrorist groups. In the context of resettlement, it means that no person can be accepted as a refugee who has, by the legal definition, provided material support for a terrorist group.
On face, this makes perfect sense. We need to wonder, though, what kinds of situations might trigger this clause. The four different categories of support covered in the law are training, expert advice or assistance, service, or personnel. But these categories have been criticized and challenged in various courts for being too broad in practice.
Here's another question. Does material support have to be voluntary and eager? There are exceptions to these rules for when someone is coerced to provide support. But in the context of a war zone, where the forces in charge of a certain area might change from week to week, the voluntary qualification can become a gray area.
There's sort of a famous case in the Third Circuit where it was a guy who was essentially a child soldier, and his entire grounds for asylum was based on the fact that at his young age he was kidnapped and sort of forced into service by one of these militant factions. I believe it was in Sierra Leone. And an adjudicator decided at some point that, well, that sort of militant organization was a terrorist organization, and he had provided material support. He had been helping them out, and therefore he was barred from asylum. And he ultimately lost his case on that ground. And that can be a very tricky thing also when you have someone, you know, like fleeing the Syria conflict. But it gets tricky because also if you have people who are just moving through this area, like if you have a refugee who's managed to leave Syria and are entering into Lebanon, and if they bump into, say, a Hezbollah checkpoint in southern Lebanon and they pay a bribe to get out of it, get past the checkpoint, that might be considered material support for a terrorist organization. It could sort of torpedo their chances. So, yeah, it's a very strict and very, you know, I think problematic kind of part of this whole body of law.
These kinds of very difficult side effects of the material support clause say so much in themselves, but they also shine a light on a bigger issue here. In many different ways, the refugee resettlement process, which is supposed to be at its heart a way of protecting the vulnerable, can marginalize those most vulnerable in a conflict area. Those with more money, more favorable political connections, and less traumatic experience are more likely to fare well in the refugee process.
This is not a hard and fast rule, and there are policies in place to ensure that the refugees who most need relocation from a camp are prioritized in the resettlement procedure. But even throughout all the stringent processes that a refugee has to go through to enter the U.S., some fundamental inequalities still persist, grounded in social and economic inequity. As hard as the refugee journey is for anyone, opportunities are more readily available to some than to others. For the less fortunate among Syrian refugees, the road to safety is even more treacherous.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about our program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter to keep up between shows, and let us know what you think. We'll be back in January. Thanks for listening.